side. Next case for argument is Allen versus LTV, Mr. Rage.
Jeffrey Rege, I represent Thomas Allen, Thomas and Beverly Allen. I think when you look over the record in this case, I want to focus upon what happened the day after this incident occurred back on July 23rd of 1996, because a lot of this focuses upon, and obviously the defendant's argument that since you didn't have the tire, you can't prove your case, the district court agreed with that, and I think that's absolutely incorrect. For the reason that in the fact of this case, it happened by coincidence that the Firestone representative was actually there on the day that Mr. Allen was injured. He was there because there was a rash of early tire failures on these RTV tires. Now, I think when you focus upon these RTV tires, you can't think of these as passenger tires. They're very specific production lot tires. They're huge. They cost a lot of money. And they're built with the exact same specifications. Now, you have a 3 or 4 month history of these tires having big problems, failing earlier than they normally would according to the average service hours. This particular production lot had been changed in May. There were 12 front RTV tires that were built. There were 8 that were used. 5 of those 8 failed with less than 100 hours of service. And they are expected to have 1,600 to 1,700 hours of service.
Could I just quickly ask you something?
Yes, sir.
The district court found that if the tire was destroyed, it was destroyed by LTV, and you didn't object to this finding. So can we assume that you concede this point?
No, I don't concede that it was destroyed by LTV, because the duty for there's 4 parties that have a duty to preserve the evidence at the time.
That's a different question.
Right, but you.
The question who destroyed the tire is different from the question who had a duty to preserve it.
We quite frankly don't know who destroyed it. We assume, based upon what we know, that it was put in some, you know, tire bin that LTV later took out to have destroyed.
So, okay, well then, wait a minute. Was it destroyed by LTV in your view?
I don't think we have any other facts to show that it wasn't destroyed by anyone else.
So you concede that it was destroyed by LTV?
We would concede that it was destroyed by LTV. I guess I misunderstood your question.
Sorry.
as far as who. I don't think the issue of, but the issue arose before that as far as the duty to preserve the tire.
Well, is there any evidence at all that any of the other defendants played any hand in the shredding?
There is evidence that they had the tire in their possession and failed to preserve it. Yes.
Who had it in their possession?
They had a meeting.
Who is the they?
Harlan Orange from Firestone, Michael Hageman from OTR, Rich Belcher from LTV, and then Bill Haas and one other individual from Heckett. They had a meeting the day after this occurred. They all knew that Thomas Allen was injured. And during his deposition, Mr. Orange was asked questions about, well, did you understand that you should preserve the tire at that time? Yes, we did understand that. I told Michael Hageman to make sure he preserved the tire. I told Bill Haas from Heckett to make sure he preserved the rim. He had visually inspected the tire with Michael Hageman just before this meeting. They had it right before this meeting, and then they let it be destroyed. So focusing upon LTV, quite frankly,
I mean, what if that let it be destroyed? Could Firestone have grabbed the tire and run out the door?
Absolutely, because
that sounds odd, because it is owned by LTV.
No, first of all, Firestone absolutely could have taken that tire. They took 2 other tires that had failed in that same production lot and had them tested. So there's absolutely no reason they could not have taken that tire. Focusing upon ownership.
But the tire is owned by LTV.
But focusing upon
Would
ownership.
Could you answer my question?
LTV owns the tire, but focusing upon ownership.
It owns the tire. Now, usually you can't remove someone's property without his consent, can you?
Well, they obviously got consent for the other two tires, so they could have gotten consent for this tire. There's absolutely nothing to say that they couldn't have obtained consent. They five of the eight tires of those RTV that were RTV tires that were manufactured in May failed with less than 100 hours of service.
Were these owned by LTV?
What?
Were these owned by
LTV? Yes, they were, and they took two of those five tires, had them tested, and those were some of the documents contained within Exhibit 9. So there's focusing upon ownership doesn't... Firestone could have taken these tires. They took others. There's absolutely nothing...
With the consent of the owner, as Judge Bolton said.
Absolutely, but they certainly could have taken this tire also. There's nothing to say that they didn't have consent to take the tire. They didn't want to take the tire because they knew this tire was defective. They had five others of eight. They had 63% of the tires in one particular production lot that failed with less than 100 hours of service.
Those tires were all bought by LTV?
That's correct. And they Firestone paid them back for all of those eight tires, actually all 12 tires, because after this incident occurred, LTV said, we don't want any of those tires on our RTVs. Take them all back. Firestone took them all back. They paid them for every single tire, including the incident tire. They could have taken this incident tire that day. They chose not to. Within 4 or 5 days after the incident, they had two other tires that were taken back.
Why didn't LTV give them back this tire?
They could have taken it. Firestone chose not to take it.
What does the record show as to whether what LTV did with the tire?
The record shows that LTV doesn't know what happened after that meeting also, because it somehow ended up in a pile of tires that would normally get destroyed. LTV doesn't have any. They've never said we wouldn't have given them the tire. We're holding that tire hostage. They've never said that. There's no evidence in the record to say that they did that. Firestone chose not to take it, and the reason they did is because if you, even without Mr. Dingman's testimony, if you look at the facts of this case and the expected service hours for these tires, the expected failure rate for these tires, that alone would provide circumstantial evidence of a product defect, because none of the other conditions changed during the time that this incident happened. I mean, they knew what they were doing. They're very sophisticated. I mean, Harlan Orange is there by coincidence the day that this happens because he's investigating a rash of early tire failures. They learn of this incident the day after. They have a meeting. They say, we should preserve this evidence. The duty arose then. They knew of an injury.
Were you retained in this case at the time?
No, our law firm, I became involved in this case in June of 2000. Our law firm was retained by the timelines. We were retained after the tire was destroyed in about spring of 1997.
Was there any other law firm retained before you?
I don't believe so, no. No, there was not.
Does the defense attorney for the company have any obligation to see that any exhibits that might be brought before the court be retained?
Well, Harlan, I'm not sure what you mean.
I said, in your version, does the defense attorney, people representing Firestone, LTV, have an obligation with the court when they know that there's going to be litigation to see that the exhibit is retained?
I believe they don't have to go into court to preserve evidence.
I didn't ask you that. That's not what I asked you. I said that the defense attorney for either those individuals or corporations, knowing there's going to be litigation, do they have any obligation to see that the exhibit is retained?
I think the obligation is upon the person who's going to bring the litigation. Not upon Mr. Allen, the person who is going to have, I mean, you focus upon ownership, I would say possession and control. The person who has possession and control of the incident equipment.
When was this suit commenced?
I'm sorry?
When was this suit commenced in relation to the time of that meeting?
It, It was a year and a half later.
Okay.
It was long after that meeting, but if you're going to put the burden upon the plaintiff...
I didn't even mention the plaintiff.
Well, I understand, but if you're going to...
You didn't get into it for a year and a half.
Well, that's true, but if you're going to focus upon that, if you're going to say, because the district court talked about that, the district court mentioned, well, you know, why didn't Mr. Allen run into court and get a protective order? Well, if you're going to focus upon that, then we're going to promote litigation.
Counsel, I've tried far more of these than you have.
Absolutely.
I've just asked you, I didn't even mention the plaintiff.
Okay.
If you had listened, you'd understand.
I understand. I was just trying to make a point of what I think the district court was focusing upon, which I didn't believe was correct.
I don't care what the district court did. I wasn't talking about them.
All right.
What's the status of the separate spoliation suit? And is LTV in bankruptcy?
LTV is in bankruptcy, and their assets have been taken over by ISG, and the other case is waiting for a ruling in this case. I'd like the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rogge. Mr. Merkel?
Good morning. The three elements I'd like to address were the procedural issues and the spoliation issues, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the facts as they've been presented. As Mr. Rogge has told the court, these are not your everyday tires. They are. This one was 37 inches wide and 39 inches long, and they are used up in the process of being put on these machines.
Let me ask you something. According to Heckett and Harsco, Heckett charged LTV for the damage to the RTV from the tire blowout.
Correct.
Okay. LTV paid Heckett, and then Firestone reimbursed LTV.
Correct.
Isn't that an admission of liability by Firestone?
No, it's not, Your Honor. It's part of it's an adjustment program that is in the course of using these tires. Because, in fact, these tires, over their useful life of 1,600 or 1,700 hours, if they fail sooner, they are adjusted, and they're actually given credit for these tires. So anything that arises out of that fail.
So in other words, Firestone would have paid damage if the blowout was caused by running over a raccoon?
They would have then looked at that situation and said, no, there's impact damage, and that we're not going to adjust it because there was outside influence. You underinflated it. You hit something, and that caused the damage.
Well, that's...
seems to exclude
everything
except the defect, right?
Well, no, because if there is causes that are multiple causes, you know, or we can't determine the cause, then we will go ahead and adjust it. Or we may, if there is an issue that the customer is really upset about, then we may go ahead and adjust it anyway.
Doesn't it seem like kind of an admission here?
I don't think so, because they adjust them every day. I mean, they do these adjustments every day. If you've got a good customer, like Mr. Reggie said, these are expensive tires.
But not if I ran over my raccoon.
If I ran over my raccoon, I would say they would look at it and say, should it have failed for running over a raccoon? You know, did you have any fault in that? No. Well, then we're going to go ahead and adjust it. If you ran into the side of the building and caused the damage, well, then I think, you know, then we would look at whether or not there was fault on the part of the operator.
But it sure does sound sort of random, doesn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, there is no set pattern as to why they would do an adjustment, other than if it didn't the life of the tire was not met, if there was some other damage and other causes.
Were there any repairs to the rim after the incident and before the rim was placed back in service?
Not according to any of the records that we have. It was just seen out around and put back in service.
Does a potential defendant have any duty to preserve the evidence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. One, the defendant may not even know that there's a claim. According to what we knew, we had attended a meeting as a part of this adjustment process. We just happened to be there. The defendant can't have that duty, because then in essence, if you impose that duty on every defendant...
Well, but Mr. Rogge said you're Firestone, right?
I'm Firestone, yeah.
That you had taken back several other tires.
Right. As part of this adjustment.
Didn't you take them back because of all the problems Firestone was having at that time?
No, Your Honor. This would have been pre any of the other recall information.
No, but you had information of what was going on around the country.
About
Firestone tires as a whole and these particular tires.
We knew about these particular tires. This would have been, this accident was in July of 1996. So this would have been pre-August 2000 is the Firestone recall with the ATX.
We're not talking about the recall. Okay. Didn't Firestone have knowledge of what was going on in the industry with their tires?
We have knowledge that tires fail every day.
No, but these particular fat tires.
And these tires as well, and that's why you were settling them. So there wouldn't be lawsuits.
We're not
kind of settling. Batch of these
defective you're changing.
Tires.
We're changing these tires.
And giving them brand new tires.
Because, yes, we are. Because these tires have a life that they of hours that they look at, 1,600 hours. If they don't make that 1,600 target, then we may give them 80% of the value.
They all do that.
Right. And they are, and that's the nature of this beast. This is a tire that is measured in hours. This is a tire we know is going to fail this way. We know it's going to get run to death. It's going to get chewed up by that. By that operation,
going to happen in 100 hours.
We don't know, but we know it's going to happen sometime. It may happen zero, may happen 1600, and that's the issue. Is that just because it fails, is not evidence of a defect.
But why wouldn't you want to? You knew there was an accident. Someone had been injured. So why wouldn't you want to take the tire back and test it?
Well, because we're not going to do destructive testing of a product. I know the defendants would not have that duty. Now, we would not take possession of a product which may be involved in litigation, do destructive testing without any kind of, court order or court supervision. Our only duty at that point in time was to tell the owner of the tire, LTV, retain that tire. There may be issues arising out of this. The plaintiff would have been first in line to know that I'm going to make a claim. And then there would be a responsibility there. The owner of the tire would have to be would be second in line.
Let me ask you a different question. Now, as I recall Dingman's report, he described a report by a fellow named Finger about 10 tires, two of which were defective.
Two of which failed because of the wide beat seat area.
Right. Now, but Mr. Reggie was talking about 8 tires and 5 failed. Where is that from? I got confused.
This is part of the Exhibit 9, which was not admitted in the lower court, and then is part of the record on appeal here. But there's an adjustment history of each of these tires by serial number, and so you can see at what hours they would have failed and taken out of service, and then at some point in time after this incident. As part of our adjustment, we just said, you know what, we're just going to take all of those out of service so that you don't have to, you know, be worried about them. And LTV wanted them out of service. So that was...
And that was there? But this didn't play any role in the district court, this evidence?
No, not that I...
And was this an exhibit to Dingman's report?
It was used in Dingman's report. He had a letter report, and it was used in that. And then he had an affidavit, and those were the two items that were presented at the summary judgment side. The challenge that was made in the lower court, the Exhibit 9, did not make it into the summary judgment papers by the plaintiff, as the trial court recognized. The content of all that information was in the Dingman affidavit and his report, and that counsel had spoken about it, these are just information, spoken about it in the briefs, you know, which tires failed and how long. So that the content of this exhibit was in the record and had been considered by the court, and therefore the fact that it didn't come in was no problem.
Okay, but just looking at Dingman's little report and the and then the affidavit, what's wrong with his point that if you have 2 tires in a batch of 10 that are known to have failed because of some problem with this speed, whatever it is, and then a third one fails, why can't you infer that it's quite likely that the third failed for the same reason the 2 earlier ones failed?
They may or they may not, and that's the problem, is you can't rule out what are the other possible causes. We know tires fail for all sorts of reasons. this could have been, the reason this failed at the bee seed area is because of the air infiltration. It could be a cause, could have been caused by damage to that area during the operation. Until you have the chance to visibly see the tire, as Mr. Dingman says in his report, the visual inspection.
He can't be certain, but it's more probable than not. He thinks, as an expert in tire safety, that this tire failed for the same reason.
Correct. And he also says that the best way, in the earlier part of the report, the best way for me to determine is to do the visual inspection.
But it's not the plaintiff's fault that, that the tire vanished.
That the tire vanished?
The tire was destroyed.
And nor is it Firestone or Hackett or OTR.
Well, now do the Allens have still a claim pending against LTV that somehow was frozen in the bankruptcy proceeding?
Yes, it's been stayed. That claim still exists. In this case, it has not been dismissed. Well, the spoilation is not in this case. The separate cause of action, which is still pending in the Northern District of Indiana, has the spoilation claim, and it would still provide a remedy if that was where the plaintiffs were going.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Merkel. Mr. Giovanni?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm going to focus on the Daubert analysis in this case. The focus of Daubert, Joyner, and Kumho Tire is the methodology that the expert employs in reaching his conclusion.
So what's lacking in Dingman's methods?
Well, there is no methodology, is what our contention is.
Well, he looked at this finger report, and then he draws the sort of common sense inference of two failed because of some defect, and the third failed, probably failed for the same reason.
Your Honor, there's...
That may not be right, but I don't see why isn't it the sort of thing you'd expect a tire expert to say...
I don't think that it necessarily follows that because a tire
it's probability. But I don't see what it has to do with Daubert. It might be, not be enough evidence to allow the case to go to a jury, but why is it inadmissible? What more could Dingman have done?
In this case, I don't know what more he could have done.
Well, if he couldn't have done any more, how can he be thought to have, you know, behaved irresponsibly?
Well, Your Honor, what I was thinking on...
It all comes back to the fact your position is without the tire, they have no case.
That's very true. But there are things that in fact, I think Dingman could have done. He could have gotten exemplar tires, tested them, seen why they fail, how they fail, compared that to the videotape, compared that to the records, considered those issues. He didn't do any of that, Your Honor. He didn't do anything to analyze anything. And that really is the focus of Daubert, and is that you need... The fact of the matter is, courts are, and lawyers are not experts. And what they need to see is a plan, some kind of analysis to make a conclusion. And we didn't see that here, Your Honor. There's nothing. It's just, I read some records, I saw a video, the tire failed because of a defect. It could have failed for any number of reasons. I just don't see that there's enough there for this to proceed to the jury.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Devaney.
Thank you.
Mr. Servan?
Thank you, Your Honor. Please support. I represent Harsco and Hackett, which is a division of Harsco. I want to comment, first of all, on the rim. The rim was put back in service following the tire explosion and stayed on this RTV until April the 9th, 1998, almost three years after. And the only reason it was replaced is because it leaked some hydraulic fluid and water, so it was replaced. There were no other incidents involving this rim. The lawsuit involving my client was filed on July 15, 1998, 9 months before the rim was taken out of service. And there's absolutely no evidence in the record that the rim had anything to do with
it. Did you or anyone, maybe the case never proceeded that far, but you know there's a... There's a funny resemblance between this case and the famous old Cardozo opinion in Paul's graph. Mm-hmm. Did anyone ever argue that Allen was not a foreseeable victim?
That is my argument with respect to my client, because the only theory of liability against me is negligence. So I guess when you analyze the tort of negligence with the duty aspect, and you go through the three-prong test that Indiana has, it's not foreseeable that this was.
So that argument was made, but the judge didn't reach it. Is that?
I didn't articulate it that way, Your Honor. My argument with respect to my client is negligence. I don't really care if the product, the tire itself, is defective or not, because it's not a product case against my client. We're not under the Product Liability Act in Indiana.
Oh, I see. So you're accused somehow of negligence in operating the truck.
I'm not sure what
vehicle is.
The theory against, I guess according to the complaint, is we were negligent in regards to maintenance of the vehicle, failure to warn, those types of allegations. But when you look at the record in this case, there is absolutely no evidence that anything that my client did in terms of maintaining the RTV caused the tire explosion. If you look at their brief on page 21, where they talk about the spoilation issue, and that by not allowing the spoilation theory to go through, it defeats their product liability case. Well, the case against my client is not a product liability case; it's a negligence case, and there's no evidence at all in the record that my client was negligent. I mean, we did not own that tire, we didn't buy that tire, we didn't recommend the purchase of that tire, we didn't even put the tire on. So there's no evidence.
You just operate the vehicle, is that?
No, Your Honor, we own the vehicle.
You own the vehicle.
And lease the vehicle to LTV. However, tires is LTV's responsibility.
So it was actually LTV that was operating it?
It was an LTV employee operating the vehicle, correct. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Sterling. Mr. Araki, how much time does he have? 4 minutes?
If you agree with Firestone that there's no duty to preserve evidence in this situation on these facts when they have knowledge of an injury and they're a sophisticated defendant, you can think of them like an insurance company with this type of knowledge who obviously has...
But why couldn't they? LTV is equally sophisticated even if it's broke. Why couldn't Firestone just assume that LTV, as the owner of the product that had caused the injury, they would retain it?
Because they're the ones who made the tire. They made the tire. It's their product that was sold. If it's going to be an action based upon the defect of the tire, they're going to be the target defendant. So I don't think they can assume that LTV is going to make that occur. And especially when you have the facts of this meeting, when you had four representatives of the defendants there, they each have an obligation to make sure that tire is maintained. And that's where the cause of action against Harsco and Hackett is based in part certainly on that duty to preserve the evidence and the fact that they had knowledge of the tire failure.
Yeah, but this becomes completely unworkable, because now you're saying not only did Firestone have an obligation to preserve the tire, but so did Hackett. What are they supposed to do? You're going to have four defendants each grabbing at the tire.
I think you have... I mean, certainly you can
that
set up...
That doesn't make any sense.
I disagree with that. I mean, certainly there's been instances, for example, I used to be a defense lawyer, Your Honor, and just to give you an example, I'm sure Mr. Coffey could do the same. And Judge Coffey, I apologize. Certainly there are instances where there are multiple defendants where there is, say, a death. I'll give Beta Steel as an example. When I was a defense lawyer, Beta Steel had an explosion in their plant. They called members of our firm. I was not one who was involved. But they called members of our firm. Get over here. Somebody was killed in our plant, two or three people. Defense lawyers went that day to the plant, set up a protocol and a procedure to preserve every single piece of evidence. And they preserved it. It's you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We have a case against GM resulting from a fire in a 1995 Pontiac Grand Am. We were retained within 2 weeks after a 21-year-old kid got killed in that car. What did we do? You make sure you protect, you preserve that car. We told our clients, you preserve that car. We filed suit, and a year and a half later, we have the car. It's been preserved. GM has requested an inspection. They're going to be allowed to inspect it. We took the obligation to preserve that evidence within 2 weeks And just like defendants are in a much better position in this particular instance to preserve evidence, otherwise you are promoting Club E, all right, where we have a well-publicized death in, in a nightclub, and the day that that happens, there's a lawsuit filed. If you agree with Firestone, that's what's going to have to happen in every single claim. Lawsuit filed that day to make sure evidence is maintained, and I don't think that obligation should be upon the plaintiff under these facts. The obligation to preserve the evidence should have been on the defendants, especially given the fact that they knew about an injury that the day after, and they had a meeting where they said, we should do this.
How much work did Dingman do in preparing his report? Is his bill in the record, or?
He did as much as he could with what he was able to work with. I don't know the specific amount of his bill. $2,000-$4,000, something like that. Okay, mm-hmm. Because he was basically sent Exhibit 9, and I can tell you, from the record in this case, we didn't get all the stuff for Exhibit 9 until about June or July of 2000, when we set Harlan Orne's deposition, and those exhibits are really the crux and that lay together all the facts and show, the facts of this meeting, and we got the details of this meeting in August of 2000 or July of 2000 when his deposition was taken.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Rogge, and thank you to